It's okay? Okay. So last time we were doing a lot of perturbation theory of super jam mills, well, of jam mills. And one of the things we realized is that in twisted space, these amplitudes have very nice properties. They localize on certain curves in twisted space. But something that was also clear, and I hope it was very, very clear, was that the twisted space description treats positive and negative helicity particles in a very different way. Okay. Do you remember somebody asked the other day, well, what happens if instead of computing the minus minus all plus amplitude, you compute the plus plus and minus minus minus? Then I said, well, in Minkowski space, all you do is a parity transformation, but in twisted space, you have to suffer because the other ones are given by these very complicated curves that have many, many intersections of P1s. Okay. Now the question is, can we have a description of Jan-Mills theory that does the same thing? Okay. Well, we know very well that the axiom for Jan-Mills is given as 1 over G Jan-Mills squared, the integral in spacetime of the trace of the curvature squared. Okay. Where the curvature is dA, is basically the curvature of a connection. Okay. Now there is nothing funny here, okay? But what about if we want to do perturbation theory? If we want to do perturbation theory, we cannot use this action the way it's written, right? What do we have to do? Well, we have to canonically normalize the kinetic terms. Okay, and for that, we rescale the fields in such a way that the coupling will appear here, okay? With canonically normalized things, the coupling will appear here. And if we take the limit when the coupling goes to zero, we don't have any interaction vertices. That's not very surprising, right? So G equals zero implies that the theory is free, and the way to see that is that there are no interaction vertices. Very good. Now I'm going to tell you a different way of writing super Jan-Mills, well, Jan-Mills theory, in such a way that when you take the weak coupling limit, there are still interaction vertices. And this is a trick. The trick is the following. Let's write S as a trace of F plus. I mean, we can always decompose this term in terms of trace of F minus minus trace of F plus, where I have an extra factor of 2 here, square. Okay. This is something that can be done where F plus and F minus, remember, are the self-dual and anti-self-dual parts. Of the curvature. Now, this part here is just a total derivative. So in perturbation theory, you don't see that. We can just forget about that for perturbation theory because it's a total derivative. Of course, in the full theory, we have to take that into account because it will measure things like instanton numbers and things like that. But in perturbation theory, we can just forget about this. Very good. Then let me rewrite this action in a slightly more complicated form. Instead of just having a function of A, the connection, I'll introduce another field G, which is a two form. And I'm going to write the action as a trace of G times F minus G jump mills square over 2 G square. Well, you can check that if you integrate out G, you recover our original action. Okay, that's an exercise. Integrate out G, and then you should recover the original action. Now it's a little bit boring to write G jump mill square all the time, so I'm just going to call this epsilon. Okay. Now note that since only the self-dual part of F enters here, only the self-dual part of G matters. So the only part that matters of G is the self-dual part. And now we can see what happens if we take the coupling G jump mills or epsilon going to 0. That's the new weak coupling limit that I want to take, right? Well, if I do that, what happens? This is a new limit. Well, it's the same limit, but of a slightly different action. So if I do that, this term is not there anymore, and all I have is basically G times dA plus A wedge A. Okay? Well, do I have interaction vertices? Well, the answer is yes. I still have one interaction vertex, even though I send the coupling to 0. I have the vertex GAA. So I have this vertex. What about propagators of this theory? Well, the propagator is only the GA propagator. Okay. Now, can I give an interpretation to these fields? What is A and what is G? Well, A, since it was a part of the self-dual curvature that entered here, GA describes a field of helicity plus 1. Okay. The reason is that when you take the equations of motion, only the anti-self-dual part is the one that survives. Okay. On the other hand, G describes a particle of helicity minus 1. Okay, so now I can label the propagator basically as minus and plus, and the vertex as minus plus plus. So this is my new perturbation theory. These are the Feynman diagrams. I only have one propagator, as usual, and I only have one interaction vertex. So let's go ahead and do perturbation theory. Can I construct any diagram with those two things? Well, let's try. Let's see. Well, I have to start with a vertex, right? Now I have to attach the propagator somehow. So let's attach the propagator here. And then I have to attach a vertex to get the simplest diagram that I can write. What's the helicity configuration of this amplitude? Well, it's just a minus plus 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 guy. Well, too bad, right? This guy vanishes. It's exactly equal to 0. Well, that's good, because this theory is not supposed to give us something interesting, because it's a zero coupling limit of jump mills. Well, let's keep on trying. Let's see if we can push this thing to give us something interesting. Let's try, say, let's make this guy into a propagator. So it was plus, so we will make it a minus here, and then we add two more lines to make a vertex, but this is a plus plus guy. Oh, too bad again. We have just a minus plus 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 amplitude, which is again zero. Very good. Okay, so we have a perturbation theory of something that gives zero all the time. Too bad. Well, but this is telling us something. It's telling us that the whole thing will start to be more interesting once we turn epsilon on, right? So we have to make epsilon different from zero. Okay, epsilon different from zero, but small. Well, how does that help? Well, it helps because it gives us a new term in the Lagrangian, which is of the form G squared epsilon. Is this a new interaction vertex? No, right? It's just a piece in the kinetic term, right? Well, but this guy will modify the matrix that you use to calculate the propagators, right? Because now the matrix here was completely off diagonal. And now we have a diagonal term, which will produce an AA propagator, meaning a plus plus propagator. Do you see that? Because we have to take the inverse. If we have a non-zero entry in the GG component, the propagator is the inverse of that matrix, so we get a non-zero component in the AA part. Now, can we do something more interesting to our perturbation theory? Well, let's see. Suppose that now you take this plus propagator. And you make it into a propagator with plus plus. Now you can use a vertex. And there you go. You got something non-zero, right? Why is non-zero? Because this is our MHB, guys. It has two minuses and a bunch of pluses. So each propagator comes with a power of epsilon. So what we are learning is that if you add a minus, this implies that you add one power of epsilon because you add one of these plus plus propagators. Okay? So the conclusion is that an amplitude with q minuses and any number of pluses comes from a term that has q minus 1 powers of epsilon, right? Remember that g is our guy of negative helicity, so we have q powers of this guy and q minus 1 powers of this guy in the effective action, if we want to think about that. Now, the last thing I want to do with this perturbation theory, which, by the way, you see, it treats very differently plus and negative helicity guys. So this has to have some relation to twisted space. This is almost what we want. So, yes. Why is it what? Brilliant. So here somebody noticed that the power of epsilon, let me call it D, is exactly equal to Q minus 1. So this looks like the formula we had for the degree, right? Well, we're going to spend the rest of the lecture trying to prove that. This is our goal for the rest of the lecture. Okay. So let me just say one more thing. Let me introduce a U1 transformation, which is not a symmetry of the Lagrangian, but it's going to be a bookkeeping device. It's just a device to keep track of how many powers of epsilons I'm adding, okay? It does the following. It's generated by S, okay? This is a generator, S, and the charge of G the S charge of G is minus 4, okay? The S charge of A, I define it to be 0. So if you do that, you see that the Jan-Mills Lagrangian is written as a term that doesn't have epsilon. So the term that doesn't have epsilon has S charge minus 4 plus epsilon, a term with S charge minus 8, okay? This is just something I simply want to do in order to keep track of the appearance of epsilon. So a term that contributes to this Q guy with Q minus helicity gluons violates the S charge, violates the S symmetry by this much, by minus 4 Q, which is P plus 1. Okay, very good. Now we have that. And we ask ourselves, well, can we describe this with some string theory? Well, that's going to be the goal of today's lecture, to describe a string theory that will give or will shed some light on all these things that we talked last week and, well, this week. And all what I've described now. And that would be twister string theory. Okay, thanks. Well, but what is twister string theory? As I told you during the first lecture, we will have to introduce many things in order to understand what twister string theory is. The first thing we have to introduce is the notion of a topological field theory. In particular, we will start with an n equals 2 supersymmetric field theory in two dimensions. So we have two charges. Q alpha and Q beta, okay? So the first index, the index alpha and beta, is the index of the SO2 Lorentz generator, and the other index, plus and minus, are the charges under a U1 internal symmetry, okay? Now, the algebra looks like the algebra in four dimensions that you learned last week, okay? It's just the only difference is that the gamma matrices here, that are the Dirac gamma matrices in two dimensions, are nothing but sigma 1 and sigma 2 of the Pauli matrices, okay? Now, I've shown as well the commutators of the Lorentz generator J. So this is the generator of rotations. So you see that Q normalized, we can find eigenvalues of Q under the Lorentz generator. I denote them by plus minus. So they have charge plus minus 1/2, indicating that they have a spin 1/2. Under the R charge, they transform in a very similar way, okay? Now, the interesting thing is that there is a linear combination of the charges Q that is nilpotent. That means that Q squared is equal to 0. Well, have you seen something that is useful when you have Q squared equals 0? Well, you have seen that in your quantum field theory courses when you do the BRST quantization, or in a string theory, that we also do BRST quantization, okay? And we would like to interpret Q as a BRST operator, but that's not possible because the BRST operator is usually a scalar, right? But here, Q is not a scalar. Q transforms as a spinner under the SO2 Lorentz group. How can we solve that problem? Well, the answer is that do a topological twist. I'm going to tell you why this is called topological in the net transparency, but let me just tell you that that's the name. It's basically a twist, I would call it. The idea is to redefine the Lorentz generator, and I call it J prime, by a shift with the internal symmetry. So somehow we are locking the Lorentz group with the internal symmetry in such a way that whenever our Q changes under the Lorentz group, the internal symmetry will make it back so that it will be a scalar. So that's the trick. Under this guy, Q is a scalar. The energy momentum tensor also changes and is given by this formula. And what is important about this guy is that now you can show that is given as the anti-commutator of our BRST operator with some object. We don't care about what the object is. The dimension of what? Oh, because we want to do a string theory. Yes. No, very good question. Yes. I didn't motivate why the dimension was two at all. The basic idea is that we saw that in order to describe all these objects, we have somehow to have a theory that lives on these curves. These curves were S2s inside CP3, right? Were CP1s. So we need something that lives in two dimensions. Okay, but something that we also know from our quantum field theory courses is that the physical states, once you have a BRST operator, are given by the cohomology of Q, meaning a state, to be physical, has to be annihilated by Q. Okay? And we identify two states that differ by a Q exact object, which means that it's precisely Q of something. What about physical operators? Well, physical operators have to commute with Q, and they are also defined up to things that are commutators or anti-commutators of Q. Okay? Now, why the name topological? Why are these theories topological? Well, Oguri is going to tell you a lot of things about topological field theories next week or the week after. But let me just tell you why the name arises. The reason is that if you consider the correlation function of just a bunch of physical operators, remember, these are physical guys, which means that they commute with the BRST charge, and you take a variation of the metric in this two-dimensional surface, what's going to happen? Well, we know very well that if you take a variation of the metric, when you take that variation on the action, you pick an integral of the energy momentum tensor, right? That's basically the definition of the energy momentum tensor. Now, we saw that T tilde was given as the anticommutator of Q with something. Now, Q is a symmetry of the theory, annihilates the vacuum, so we can always move it to one side or the other, because it commutes or anti-commutes with the physical operators, and we get zero. Okay? So all the correlation functions in this theory of physical operators do not depend on the metric. Well, if you have something that doesn't depend on the metric, how would you call it? Yes? There are what, sorry? The correlation functions. Well, everything depends. You have to cancel anomalies if you have anomalies, like in a string theory. In fact, we will see that anomalies will play a role later on. Okay. But we know our target space. We don't want just any target space. We want CPM, well, we want CP3, but let me give a generic discussion of CPM-1, okay? Let's describe the CPM-1 model. So there are maps, Zi, that go from our two-dimensional surface into X, which is CPM-1. The sigma model, as it's called, is just given by the action, which is basically the area of this guy written in the way Polyakov wrote the action for the string, by introducing gamma, the internal metric, plus this term here. This D is just an auxiliary field. Its only purpose in life is to impose a constraint. What is a constraint? Well, that whatever multiplies D is equal to zero, right? Now, why is this a model that lives in CPM-1? The reason is the following. These D's are covariant derivatives because I also impose that there is a U1 in the theory. Now, CPM-1 is described by this identification on CM, right? If these are variables in CM, I identify by T in C star, and I get CPM-1. Now, T, let me write it as rho times a phase, where rho is a positive number. Now, the constraint imposes that on the slice of possible rows, I just pick one of them, okay? What about the phase? Well, the phase is precisely the gauge equivalence, okay? So the gauge equivalence plus the constraint tells me that this model describes maps from a two-dimensional object to CTM minus one. But I told you that we also want to do the supersymmetric version. Somehow everything will have to be related to n equals 4 supersymmetry, to n equals 4 superjamians. So let me introduce CPM minus 1 slash P. What does a P mean? It means that I take my CP1 coordinates, ZI, and I just add to them fermionic coordinates. Now these are anti-commuting objects, okay? Psi A. I add P of them. The U1 also acts on them, okay? And it turns out that, well, all of them, the action that you can write, which is a supersymmetric generalization of this action on top, describes these coordinates up to this transformation T, okay? So this is indeed a CPM minus 1 slash P. Now, something very nice happens, which is the following. If the target space X is a Keller manifold, which you know what it is because you took Paul's course, right? Then a miracle happens. Automatically, the supersymmetric theory with this size becomes an n equals 2 supersymmetric theory. Okay? This is what we wanted. We wanted an n equals 2 theory in CPM minus 1. So that we can do the topological twist. So let's do the twist. But remember, in order to twist something, we need an R symmetry, right? Well, in this case, it happens that we have two R symmetries. This theory has two. If you call theta, well, the two-dimensional surface, we can also make it a super Riemann surface by adding fermionic coordinates theta, okay, to the usual coordinates x. Now, there is an axial R symmetry which rotates theta plus and theta minus with different charges. And there is a vector-like R symmetry which rotates both of them with the same charge. Well, it turns out that one of them will lead to what is called the A model, and the other one to the B model, okay? Well, the reason is that we have to choose one or the other in order to do the twist. Once you do the twist, you end up with a topological field theory. So we have the two choices. Now the question is, should we choose A or B? Well, you already know the answer, right? Because I wrote many times that we're gonna do the B model. But why is that? Well, the A model lives very happily on any space for any P. Somehow, that's not very nice, because we want to describe n equals 4 superjamians. What about B? Well, the B model only allows P equals M, OK? Remember that M, in our case, is equals to 4, because we want to work in CP3, right? Well, that means that the B model naturally picks n equals 4 as its only possible background when it's living on CPM minus 1 slash P. So maybe that's the correct one. There are better reasons, but I mean, this is just something nice. I mean, choose the one that naturally lives in the space of that describes an n equals 4 supersymmetry. Now let me tell you why the B model can only live in a space that has P equals M. Classically, the R symmetry, the axial R symmetry, is a symmetry of the theory. But it turns out that quantum mechanically, there is an anomaly. And the anomaly is proportional to the first Chern class of the manifold. Well, if the first Chern class vanishes and is a Keller manifold, what manifold do we have? We have a Calabi-Yau space, right? Well, an equivalent statement is that a Calabi-Yau manifold is something where you have a globally defined holomorphic top form, right? Top form means that it's the highest form that you can, that this space can support. Well, let's try to write the natural top form on this space. It's given by this, okay? Now, If you make a U1 transformation, this guy will be invariant, meaning well-defined, if and only if M is equal to P. Can anyone tell me why is that true? The Z's transform as E to the I with charge 1, E to the I alpha. The Psi's transform with E to the I alpha as well. How come that this is symmetric, that this is invariant? Well, if this transforms like this, and this is a Grassmann variable, deep psi transforms as e to the minus I alpha, deep psi, right? Well, I'm sure you all of you knew this, right? Because this is the only way to make this consistent, the integration of Grassmann variables. Okay, very good. So now we know that we have to leave from this super twisted space. Okay, if we set M equals 4, we are in a super twisted space. Now, what's the advantage of using a topological field theory? Well, the advantage is that this BRST operator that defines your physical states will usually have correspondences with some nice geometric meaning, will have a nice geometric meaning for the target space. In this case, in the B model, Q maps in the target space to the del bar operator. Well, that's very nice because we know what the physical states are now. They are just the cohomology classes of the del bar operator. Okay? Well, we can give them a 0, P form, some X, with values in the Q antisymmetric tensor product of the tangent space of X. Okay? Well, that's not very important. We can just remember that these are 0, P forms. Okay? Now, here we come to something that is similar to what we were discussing here. Remember that an R symmetry is a transformation that you make on the fermionic variables. So suppose that you make this transformation S on the fermionic variables that leaves the bosonic variables invariant. I call this a would-be twister R symmetry. Well, why is a would-be twister R symmetry? Well, the reason is that it's not a symmetry. Right? Well, why is that? Well, something that we are seeing here is that the B model somehow usually picks everything holomorphic or anti-holomorphic, but not the two things together. So psi bar never shows up anywhere. And we will see that all descriptions of correlation functions and things like that will involve the holomorphic three-form omega, which under this transformation has charge minus 4, okay? So our correlation functions and everything in the theory will not be invariant under this would-be R symmetry. Well, remember our S operator there, so you can guess that there is gonna be some relation between the two things. Well, but what about the gauge group? We want to describe Jan Mills' theory with a UN gauge group. And up to now, our sigma model doesn't have any gauge group in the target space. Well, let's add, as usual in a string theory, n D5 brains. Now, these D5 brains wrap the whole CP3. But they don't quite wrap the whole fermionic variable, the whole fermionic directions. They only wrap the holomorphic ones, not the psi bars. We will see why we need that in the next transparency. But for the moment, let's remember that these guys are almost space-filling deep brains. as I told you before, the B model, in the physical states of the B model, are just 0, P forms. And living on these T5 ranges, we will also have 0, P forms. Now, when you write the axiom with all values of P, or all the possible values of P, you realize that something interesting happened. You have that the 0, 1 form, which is a connection, okay, it's just a one form, describes a kind of Jan-Mills theory, or a kind of gauge theory, sorry. And all the higher forms will play the role of the ghosts when you quantize this guy. So the other guys don't have a physical meaning in space-time. Well, sorry, in the target space, which is not space-time. This is twister space, the target space of this theory. What about the effective action of the degrees of freedom living in this D5 range? Well, in order to derive that, you have to do open a string field theory. That would be the nicest way to derive this. But we don't have time for that. So let's try to guess what it has to be. The effective action has the following properties. The first one, it depends only on A, which is a 0, 1 form. It doesn't depend on the 1, 0 form, A bar. Okay. The Lagrangian has to be a 3, 3 form so that we can integrate it over CP3. Right? Otherwise, we cannot do the integration. What's the other ingredient that we have at our disposal? Just the holomorphic free form. And the action has to be gauge invariant. Well, this is pretty much what you can write that is gauge invariant and satisfies the properties I mentioned. This is called the holomorphic Chern-Simons theory. You can guess why it's called the holomorphic guy. Well, but up to now, we did everything in the bosonic sector, okay? We forgot about the fermionic directions. So let's write the SUSY version. The 0, 1 form becomes a superfield, okay? A super 0, 1 form that depends on Z, Z bar, and psi. It doesn't depend on psi bar. Here comes the restriction. Now, as it doesn't depend on psi bar, we can perform the expansion and just go up to here. Okay? This is the usual superfield expansion that you did last week. Okay? So we see that we can go up to this term that has 4 psi's. If we include one more term, we will get 0 because we have to repeat one of the psi's. Right? These two guys, A and G, they will play a special role, as you can see there. They are not the same A and Gs, okay? So these are space-time fields, and these are twister space fields. The action is just given by the supersymmetric version. Very good. So now we come to a very important point in the whole discussion, okay? The observation is the following. These psi A's are sections of O1 over CP3. This only means that they have a certain transformation when you go from one patch to the other. They transform with certain power of the coordinates, which is 1. Okay? Now, the field A is a section of O0, which means that it's just a function. It doesn't transform when you go from one patch to the other one. In order to make these two things consistent here, the fields A all the way to G will have to be sections of different bundles of O0, -1, -2, -3, and -4. Well, also remember that the S charge of the fields, the way I've defined them, psi has charge 1, and therefore they will have to have charges 0 to -4. In order to make A an invariant field. Okay. Any questions up to here? Okay, very good. So here comes the most important part. Well, you have, when you want to construct correlation functions, as I told you before, the way to do it is with a holomorphic form, okay? The amplitude that you have in twisted space and the wave function of the external particles. That would be the correlation function that will give you the physical amplitudes. Last time, we discussed that in twisted space, the amplitudes are sections of O minus 2 minus 2H. And we derive that from this equation, okay? So omega is a section of O4, A tilde is a section of O minus 2 minus 2H. And this is something we don't know. The wave function of the particle is a section of OL. So we have no idea what L is. This H is the helicity of the given particle in space-time, which translates to twisted space in this form. Now, in order to do the integration, we need a well-defined object when you multiply the three things together. That means that the product of the three guys has to be a function or a section of O0. Therefore, 4 plus this plus L has to be 0. So that's the link between the section a given field is of and the helicity that this field corresponds to in space-time. Okay? So if you solve this very difficult equation for L, this is something even I can do, you get that a field that is a section of OL corresponds to a field of helicity 1 plus L half in space-time. Now let's review our field content and see how that translates into space-time. We have, from A to G, we had that they were sections of OL with L O to minus 4. Therefore, they correspond in space-time to fields with helicity all the way from 1 to minus 1. That's great. Why is that great? Because this is the N equals 4 supermultiplet. So our theory magically has the field content in space-time of N equals 4 supergermials. Well, you can also check that they have the correct R charges under the SU4 R symmetry group. And now your question at this point should be, are we there yet? Is this enough to prove that this string theory reproduces N equals 4 supergermials? Well, you can also rephrase the question and ask, does the action, even by this, turn into the Jan-Mills action in space-time? Okay? If the answer is yes, then we can stop and go home. And as you can see, it's not time to go home yet. So the answer is no. Okay? Well, how can we see that? A very simple way to see that is that the S charges, if you look at the S charges, this piece was invariant under S, and this guy, omega, has charge minus 4. Therefore, all what this guy can do is reproduce the minus 4 charge piece of the Lagrangian, this guy here. The one that you get when epsilon is equal to 0. So after all this work, all we can do is just the plus is the minus plus 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 amplitudes, which are all 0. Okay? But don't give up. We still have one more trick, which are the instantons. The B model can have the instantons. Well, we want to have the one instantons. It means that they are two-dimensional guys that can wrap these holomorphic curves in CP3. Here we have them. And as usual with deep brains, you have a U1 field, right? Whenever you have a deep brain, you have a U1 field. But in addition to that, You also have the modes that describe the motions of this D instanton in CP3. Well, we have to parameterize this moduli space, how this D instanton can move in CP3, okay? And let me do it for genus 0, okay? And here I have to say that I don't know how to do it for genus 1. That's the reason I'm gonna do it for genus 0. But, so let's do it for genus 0 anyhow. So let's take C, which is gonna be our S1 or our CP1, parameterized by U1 and U2, okay? These are the two homogeneous coordinates on the CP1. And phi is a map from this curve into CP3/4, okay? Now, if it's a curve of degree D, let me do degree D, the ZIs will just be given by these products, and the psi is by these products, okay? So the meaning of degree D is that I have precisely a polynomial of degree D in the U variables, okay? Very good. Now, what's the space of the formations? Well, roughly speaking, it's not exactly that one, but roughly speaking, would be the space of those coefficients, of the Cs and the betas. Okay, and the measure, we have to integrate over that moduli space, and the measure will be given by the natural measure on the space of these guys, which is just d, c, and d beta over all c's and betas. But how many of them do we have? Well, we have, for each c, we have how many? 4 times d+1, right? And for the other ones, we have 4 times d+1. Why is the plus 1? If these guys are of degree D, well, because a polynomial of degree D has d+1 coefficients, right? Now, what about the S charge? Remember that psi transforms, it has charge 1. Z doesn't have any charge, it has charge 0 under S. Therefore, C has charge 0, but beta has charge 1. Again, D beta, because beta is a fermionic coordinate, will have charge -1, and we have that this guy, this measure, violates S by -4 d+1, okay? So you can see that we're getting closer to the question somebody asked at the beginning, okay? We're getting closer to this equation. In fact, we are there, right? The reason is the following. In order to get a non-zero contribution when you have this D instanton with this fermionic zero mode, you have to bring, or you have to put precisely d+1 factors of G. Remember that G was the field that corresponds in the space-time to minus helicity. The reason is that each G comes with psi 1 to psi 4. And that's the only way to get a non-zero contribution when you have the product of the D psis or the D betas, as we will see in an example. Therefore, the number of minus helicities is related to the degree of the curve by this formula or this formula, which is what we wanted, okay? Well, here comes the part I don't know how to do very well. But one can argue nobody has actually constructed the measure. Okay, but one can argue that for genus greater than 0, the S violation is -4 d+1 - g, and that implies that the degree is precisely what Witten conjectured. Okay, very good. So we know what to do. The question is, can we compute something with this? Yes. Yes, but we said that the genus was related to the number of loops. Yes, only by inequality. Yes. Well, I told you that this issue is still not very well settled. Well, no, well, the answer to that question is simple. If you have a lower genus, you have to have several components. Like if you had a contribution where the top genus was minus, it was, I don't know, 5, then you can also allow things that are disconnected with lower genera, okay? If you do the counting, then the whole thing will account for the precise factor that I told you, okay? If you do the counting with several guys with lower genera, they will have precisely the same contribution, okay? That's why the relation is, that also reminds me that there was an exercise here for you guys, which is, the exercise is to extend this to loops and show that there, the number of epsilons that you need is precisely this one, where L is the number of loops. Okay? Okay. So in the last 10 minutes or 5 minutes, I don't know, how much do we have? 5 minutes? Okay. Let's compute something with this. So let's compute MHV amplitudes. Well, how do we do that? Well, we have to get a handle on the D1, D5 brains, the D1, D5 strings that connect or have one end on the D1 or on the D instanton and go to the D5 brains, okay? Now, again, in the B model, all we have are 0P forms. These are our physical fields. Even on the D1, we will just have 0, P forms living there. We can only have 0, 0 forms or 0, 1 forms, right? Well, the only ones that will enter here are the scalars, are the 0, 0 forms. And the action turns out to be given by this, where alpha represents the D1, D5 brains, okay? Strings. They transform under the fundamental, okay? Remember that this end of the string has to transform under some representation of the gauge group. And the D5, D1 brain, these strings transform under the anti-fundamental. There is our gauge field that leaves, that is a restriction of the gauge field that leaves in the CP3 to the CP1, okay? And it's again a 0, 0, 1 form. Well, from this coupling, from this piece of the coupling, we can read off the current, okay? X and Y represent the fundamental and anti-fundamental indices. The reason you use X and Y is that we are using I and J in many other places, but there is nothing to it. It's just a clash of notation. The external field is given by this, and the scattering amplitude, when you have these vertex operators corresponding to the external gluons coupling to the D1 instanton, would simply be the integration of the correlation function over the whole moduli space of the D1 instanton. The operators are just given by the integral over the D1 instanton of a current corresponding to the I gluon and the external wave function of the I gluon. Okay. So let's see how does the moduli space look like. For Q equals 2, we have degree 1 curves. So the maps are just very simple linear maps. Using SL2C invariance, we can set ui to be lambda I precisely. Remember that the zi's are the lambdas and the mu's. So we can set the u's to be just the lambdas. So we can change the index I by A, and we can define the corresponding coefficients, just let's call them x and theta, just because we know where they are going to end up being, precisely positioned in space-time, okay? So we have these two equations when we set u equals to lambda, and these are precisely the equations that told us that the D1 instanton, or last time, it has to be on a degree one curve, okay? Now this is a super degree one curve because we also have this condition on the fermionic variables. The moduli space is just integration over x and theta, okay? Again, we can extract the color structure of these wave functions by writing it as t times v, where v doesn't have any information about color, okay? So these are the v's. And the single trace contribution, which is the one we want to study, is given by contraptions of data lambda I with the next guy, alpha lambda I plus 1. Let's see that more precisely. What happens when you have two fermions in a string theory in two dimensions, and you do the operator product expansion? Well, you find the leading singularity is something like this. X and Y get coupled together in this delta, and you have Z minus Z prime as a singularity. Well, Z and Z prime, we can think about that as inhomogeneous coordinates in CP1, but if you want to describe the CP1 in homogeneous coordinates again, this ZI becomes this guy, and this pole becomes the inner product of these spinors. Therefore, our MHP amplitude, the single trace piece of it, is the integral over the moduli space times the product of all these pieces that were left of the vertex operators, and we get this formula here. It satisfies all the properties you would hope for, like it's homogeneous of degree zero in each lambda I, it's a 0.1 form in each lambda I, it's L to C invariant, and it has simple poles at these locations. Finally, we have to define the wave functions, but we want to do or reproduce the scattering of plane wave in space-time. A plane wave is something that has a definite momentum, okay? So this is the phi in space-time. It has a definite momentum, zeta and zeta tilde. That's how I call the spinors of this guy. And we are only two transparencies away from finishing. Okay? Now, the corresponding wave function in twister space, which is something that will map to the wave function of plane waves in space-time, is given by this, where this is a delta function that sets the lambda to the zeta of the guy. The helicity information is given here, okay? And this delta function is defined in such a way that this integration couples or sets, sorry, here it should be lambda, sets lambda of any function to the value zeta. Now remember that the helicity assignment was given by this set in the expansion. A field of helicity plus 1 is A, and helicity minus 1 comes with this factor. So G of psi should have 1 if we are describing a gluon of plus helicity, and this factor if we are describing a gluon of minus helicity. So, this is what we have to compute, okay, with the wave functions. Now, for the MHP amplitude, we have R and S of minus helicity and the rest plus, right? Now, here comes what I promised last lecture. The integration over the n equals 4 space or superspace of these two functions, each of them being psi 1, psi 2, up to psi 4, okay, here. At the location of the super degree one curve is what it gives you, is what gives you the factor of 4 in the numerator of the MHP amplitude. So this 4 and this factor precisely come from n equals 4 supersymmetry. The remaining piece just gives you a delta function of momentum conservation, okay, evaluated at the curve. Putting all together, we get the single trace factor, the momentum conservation delta function, the factor from the fermionic integration, and the factor from the correlation functions of the fermions. Well, and thus the Park-Taylor formula or MHP amplitudes derived from twister string theory, okay? So I'll stop here. Thank you. Yes, thank you. All right.